Welcome to Minds Worth Meeting. I'm Whitney Jennings.
And I'm Justin Lewis.
In this episode, we're taking a look back at the best moments of Season 3.
This season, we spoke to authors of new books on technology and global economies and heard inspiring stories of survival, acceptance, and empowering leadership.
That's all coming up on the Best of Minds Worth Meeting, Season 3.
This is Minds Worth Meeting from Stern Strategy Group, a podcast where we talk with some of the top thought leaders in the world, from business leaders and technology analysts to academics and researchers. We welcome a new Mind Worth Meeting in each episode. Here you'll find accessible, down-to-earth conversations about some of the most important topics of the day with the experts and leaders who are the top authorities in their fields. And now, here's Mind's Worth Meeting. Starting with a bonus episode, I spoke with co-director of MIT's Initiative on the Digital Economy and the inaugural Google Technology and Society Visiting Fellow, Andrew McAfee, about his new book, The Geek Way. Here, he explains the four norms of The Geek Way.
As we all know, organizations are pretty good at realizing if a change effort is just flavor of the month and if things are going to go back to business as usual, and they just wait the change out. Right. To get around that, I do believe that the top leadership of the company needs to be involved. In particular, needs to start reorienting their company around four norms, four standards of behavior, four things that are expected by the people around you. Mm-hmm. And those are speed, iterate, get feedback as quickly as possible, ownership, push responsibility and authority down to uncomfortable levels, science, argue about evidence and go where the evidence takes you, and then finally, openness, be willing to pivot, be open to the fact that you might not have the right idea or that you might need to go in a different direction, be open to both giving and receiving criticism up and down the org chart.
Next, Andy explains how he defines a geek today.
I love reclaiming this label. Yep. And taking it away from the kids that had their lunch money extracted from them by bullies in middle school, and instead redirecting it to refer to anybody who's what I would call an obsessive maverick, okay. Somebody who just gets obsessed with a tough problem, won't let it go, and is willing to embrace unconventional solutions. To me, that's my definition of geek these days.
Here, Andy tells me how a company is a technology.
The company is a thing that we humans invented to help us accomplish our goals. That's a technology. And one of the technologies that the geeks have iterated on and innovated on and spent the most time on over the past 20 years or so is the technology. And the reason I wrote the book is I became convinced that they had given the company an upgrade. They have learned how to build organizations that can kind of do it all, that can be simultaneously innovative, agile, that can execute at a high level, and that provide good environments for people to work in. This makes them really, really tough competitors. And I don't think we have seen the heart of the disruption. I think we're in the early innings of the disruption that's going to spread throughout the economy because the geek way is going to outcompete companies that don't follow it.
Finally, I asked Andy if he's an optimist or a pessimist about the unprecedented technological progress like generative AI we're seeing today.
I'm an optimist about technological progress. And I should be clear, all powerful technologies come with risks and downsides. There's just not a technology that's an unambiguous good. I don't think that's how the universe works. Okay. We need to pay attention to those downsides, but I don't think we should let them dominate the conversation. I don't think we should let them dominate our perception of what's going on. Hmm. Powerful technologies are generally put to good uses by most people because most of us aren't bad actors or evil human beings. Right. The bad actors are going to get a hold of very powerful technologies and they're going to do harmful things with them. And that's a damn shame. And we need to learn how to deal with that. That's different than being pessimistic about the technologies themselves.
In our official kickoff to Season 3, Justin sat down with UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism lecturer Nick Romeo to discuss his new book, The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. Here, Nick explains that the goal of the book is to bring economic policy together with real human stories.
Those two streams of inquiry, I've always been sort of wonky and analytical by nature, but I also really appreciate the power of character, of narrative, of the kind of what is it like feel for some of these issues. And, you know, especially when you're writing about things that can sound kind of technocratic, labor market policy, the details of corporate ownership, I think there's an additional reason to really kind of give a human dimension to these topics.
So it's helping people learn something, but also helping people feel something.
Well put, absolutely.
Continuing that stream of thought, Nick says that while the country is divided on many issues, it is possible to find common ground through economic programs.
Despite a lot of the polarization and conflict in the country, it's actually not at all impossible to find this kind of reasonable middle ground where if you're willing to just get down to specifics, reason about some of these moral principles that underlie economic arrangements, there's, I think, a lot of common ground that can still be had. And the goal of the book is to try to expose that, highlight it, and broaden it, sort of have a big tent strategy, if you will.
One of the programs Nick described is a village in Austria that's experimenting with job guarantees. Here, he points to the psychological benefits of such a program.
The presence of somewhere to go every day and the fact of having colleagues, collaborators, doing something you think is meaningful has incredible psychological benefits for folks.
Sure.
So even apart from having income, which they could have from their unemployment benefits, really the intervention has been that it's a profoundly meaningful thing for people who are otherwise maybe just going to be like that person in the 1930s, where that you wake up and you say, what am I going to do all day?
Staying with the job guarantee experiment, he dispels a common myth about the cost of these types of programs.
If your objection to a job guarantee is that it's going to cost too much, this program in Austria is interesting because they very intentionally capped the cost such that it came in just below what they would have been spending anyway on the unemployment benefits for these folks. So that objection is kind of automatically foreclosed. It's if you're in a country with relatively generous unemployment benefits, you can mount a job guarantee without exceeding that budget. It's kind of hard to see why you wouldn't be interested in doing that if you're going to be spending the money anyway, and if people are much more satisfied, and if you can actually contribute to some needs in a community,
sure.
Infrastructure, green transition. I mean, you can imagine the crisis in care work in America. It's not hard to think of things that need doing, and it's not hard to think of people who are not satisfied in their current jobs.
Finally, Nick told me the main takeaway he hopes his journalism students leave his class with.
I think just like a really intellectually rigorous attempt to interrogate your own preconceptions and to kind of push back against some of your own ideas, to phrase the counterarguments to your viewpoints in the strongest possible version so that you're not just kind of coming up with a straw man and saying, oh, well, my opposition, they're all just kind of stupid and they're all evil and I figured out truth and righteousness, and now I'm going to tell the world about what's true and right. I think in order to have any kind of credibility, you have to give the opposition a very careful consideration. And, In journalism, this means talking to a lot of people, including people you disagree with. And it's not that there's no truth and that, you can't have a viewpoint, but it's that to arrive at that viewpoint in a credible way, you have to kind of have stress tested it
right.
By checking with everyone who disagrees with you and taking seriously what they say.
Our next episode was one of our most inspiring yet. Justin and our Stern marketing team colleague Meg Vierig spoke with author and Holocaust survivor Tova Friedman, who told us about one of the easiest ways to be courageous, having the courage to be wrong.
If you listen, you're afraid they'll convince you. People don't want to hear somebody else's opinion, because if you're going to tell me that, you know what, maybe you're right, I have to change my mind, and that means that I was wrong. And people are afraid to do that. The courage to be wrong. It's very important to be able to say, you know what? I was wrong.
Next, Tova emphasizes the importance of recognizing what we have in common over our differences.
It's the phobia of the stranger.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is that we have a lot in common, much more than we're different. And I think we'd know that. If you know that, there would be so much less hatred and prejudice.
I asked Tova what she would tell world leaders if she had the chance. It turns out she did have the chance to do just that.
I spoke at the UN. There were 30 ambassadors from different countries. And I said that each one's responsibility is to fight the hatred. It doesn't matter against whom. And I think this is what the leaders must address in their own country. They have to look at their country and say, what's going on? Is this supposed to be a country of hatred or a country of peace?
Explaining how we all feel anger and love, Tova shares a story about how to contend with those conflicting feelings.
I heard this beautiful story. A little grandson says to his grandfather, I have these conflicting feelings. Sometimes I'm very angry and very hateful on one side. On the other side, I'm so kind and loving, and they constantly fight with each other. Do you feel the same way? And the grandpa says, yes, I do. I have the same thing. I have these wonderful feelings and these terrible feelings. And the grandson says, but who wins in this battle? And the grandfather said, the one you feed.
Finally, she shared her thoughts on the importance of connecting with others.
There used to be a time when we had pen pals or whatever. I think that's what it should happen, a little bit more connection so that the young people growing up don't feel that their responsibility is only to their community.
In our next episode, Whitney and I had an uplifting conversation with NYU professor, social psychologist, and author Dolly Chugg, who tells us what it means to be a goodish person.
And in a growth mindset, we make a mistake, maybe we're mortified, maybe we're upset, but we kind of soak up the learning that there is in that mistake. Those moments of growth in a growth mindset are what I refer to as being goodish. Instead of being a good person, this brittle, tightropey kind of mindset, we're in this like stretchy mindset where we're better today than we were last week and last month and last year and last decade. So it's actually a source of pride when you're feeling goodish to be able to talk about the things you got wrong, the jokes you used to think were funny that now you understand differently, or the shows you used to watch and now that make you cringe. Like, that's not a source of shame. That's an evidence of growth. It's evidence of being goodish, taking ownership, learning, stretching yourself as you go.
Next, Dolly explained how nostalgia is wonderful, but it's also important not to let it overshadow the reality of past wrongs.
It's exactly what the research says about nostalgia. It gives us a sense of belonging. It gives us a sense of safety. It gives us a sense of connection. There's all these psychological benefits to that sentimental version of thinking about the past. That's kind of cool. The only thing is, when we live in a society that has a past that's had both beauty and brutality, that's had both honor and horror, if we only understand the sentimental version of that, the beauty and the honor, not the brutality and the horror, we will not be able to understand the society we live in now.
A leadership expert, Dolly tells us what she sees as one of the most important takeaways from her class for future leaders.
I hope my students leave the course first and foremost, remembering, internalizing that a boss is human. And it sounds like such a simple takeaway, but that is not the narrative we have imbibed our entire lives, whether it's from the workplace or from the media. And it's a really costly narrative to lose our humanity as bosses, because it makes it so difficult to raise the psychological safety in the workplace. It makes it so difficult to stimulate positivity, to give tough feedback, to raise performance standards, to deal with crisis. These are all moments where we need our humanity to rise to the forefront.
To be a good leader, she goes on to explain that bosses must understand their team members as individuals.
We need to be able to understand people as individuals. We need to be able to show up as who we are and recognize the impact, have the self-awareness to realize the way we sometimes show up does not work for our entire team. And we need to be able to sort of moderate the impact we're having on others, particularly when things are stressful.
Finally, deep in conversation with Dolly, we were treated to a surprise guest appearance.
And we won't understand that.
Coco Bean.
The culprit. Where is he? Coco, show your face. Is he showing up?
Oh. Yes.
Hey. Debut on Mind's Worth Meeting.
There you go, Coco. I was on a roll, too.
In our season finale, I sat down with Harvard University professor, sociologist, and author of the new book, Seeing Others, Michelle Lamont, who explains that it's vital to understand dignity as an infinite resource.
I think if people start digging in their heels, if the situation ends up being viewed as zero sum, like what you gain, I lose. Dignity is not like a pie, you know. With a pie, if you get a big piece, there's fewer pieces to go around. Whereas dignity is something that everyone can have at the same time. It is not zero sum.
Next, Michelle explains that relationships are an important part of a healthy workplace.
A workplace where colleagues know that other people have their backs makes a very great difference in quality of life. And at the end of the day, work is very much about subjective well-being, how people feel in their life. It's not only about money. It's very much about the quality of relationship with others. And many workers have experienced a bad workplace, and we know how the stress comes.
To achieve that healthy dynamic, leaders must have a diverse understanding of the workplace.
If you think about what was the ideal worker even 10, 15 years ago, you know, a man who worked 60 hours a week, and, you know, it was an image of the ideal worker that was very masculine. And I think many organizations have moved toward really having a much more diverse understanding of the workplace and also making more room for the fact that we're not only producers of work, but we're also human beings with many responsibilities. There's research showing that organizations that are giving their employees time to bring their kids to the doctor succeed much better, in part because they can retain their staff better. And they have workers who are much more fulfilled in the workplace, which generates much more loyalty.
Michelle goes on to tell us that transforming narratives is vital to destigmatizing groups.
A lot of knowledge workers, legal experts, medical experts, social scientists, journalists that contribute to transforming the narratives through which groups are viewed. And those groups can be ethno-racial minorities, sexual minorities, but also, frankly, everyone. And that obligation or the role of transforming these narratives should go not only to people of color who are typically in charge of DEI programs or toward women, but this is a responsibility that should be shared by all middle-level managers. That creation of a workplace that acknowledges the dignity of all workers is really to the advantage of all employers.
Finally, how do organizations make a commitment to recognition? Whitney asked Michelle.
What does a long-term commitment to giving others recognition look like?
Well, I think it's a little bit like a song in the back of your mind that you have to keep in mind as you're making decisions, not only personal decisions, but also decisions about what will be the pace of work, what are the long-term and short-term objectives, how much an organization can pursue several objectives at once, what is the human cost of having your employees do too much. So I think it should always be factored in as a dimension of how people decide to lead.
Our heartfelt thanks to our Season 3 guests, Andy McAfee, Nick Romeo, Tova Friedman, Dolly Chug, and Michelle Lamont.
We're already hard at work behind the scenes on our next season of Minds Worth Meeting. Be sure to subscribe and follow us on your favorite podcast platform to be notified when the new season kicks off.
Is there someone you'd like to hear on Minds Worth Meeting or a burning business question you'd like us to ask an expert? Email us at mindsworthmeeting@sternstrategy.com to be part of the show.
Minds Worth Meeting is a production of Stern Strategy Group. Our hosts are Whitney Jennings and Justin Lewis. Alan Halimsky is our video editor. The Minds Worth Meeting team also includes Casey Gatta, Kaylee Heverin, and Meg Vierig. Whitney Jennings is Stern Speakers and Advisors Marketing Manager. Brandon Pantano is our Digital Marketing Director. Join us next time for another episode of Stern Strategy Group's Minds Worth Meeting. Listen, rate, and share us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I was on a roll, too.